Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
My name is Leanna Wojniak. I'm here today with Dave Popowich filling in, and I'm filling in for Faisal Karmali.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for doing that. Faisal's away on a conference today, and which means it's going to be a terrific show without him pestering me all throughout the whole session. I'm just kidding. We've got a good show today. We're going to talk about tax, mm-hmm. and although that sounds maybe boring at the outset, the disability tax credit is something that I don't think is well known mm-hmm. to many people. Mm-hmm. But we talk about tax, you know, in our seminars and in the process of retirement from a 3D perspective: deduct, mm-hmm. divide, and defer. Mm-hmm. And a disability tax credit is something that's available to many Canadians that don't take advantage of mm-hmm. it.
I think people would be surprised how many Canadians are actually eligible for it and can save some money on their taxes, but just don't take advantage of it either because they're scared of applying, they don't know how to apply.
Right. And who to contact,
who
and what to,
contact,
to do.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so we'll shed some light on that for sure. Let's talk a little bit about the markets this week. Like every week these days, it's mm-hmm. you know, it's an interesting week, and there was a lot of highlights this week. What mm-hmm. sort of what comes to mind for you right off the top of your head? The biggest highlight for you?
The biggest headline of the week, I think, was the Fed's interest rate decision in the U.S.
Yeah.
It was the expected move. But we still got volatility out of it.
Yeah, well, and it's often the communication, right? Mm-hmm. I think the market had accurately priced in and predicted a 75 basis point increase mm-hmm. or 0.75%. But the communication that Fed Chair Powell gave mm-hmm. really is what sunk the markets when that decision came out.
Right, because he came out and said, we're going to do whatever it takes to slow inflation down, which the market read as, it's not going to stop. The interest rate hikes won't stop anytime soon. So,
yeah,
negative reaction to that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, some of his language was a little more hawkish, I think, than what was expected. So it was interesting. What was interesting is when that news came out, the 75 basis points, you saw a rally immediately in the mm-hmm. stock market. Then the communication came out, and the interview comes out, and some of the language used, sinks the mm-hmm. market.
Gave now, it all back. Yeah, same day.
Yeah, same day. That's right. So let's fast forward to the early trading on Friday, because mm-hmm. there was also some important economic data that came out. Mm-hmm. So give me your take on sort of the state of the labor market in Canada and the U.S.
Well, it's a different story between Canada and the U.S. U.S. saw some gains in unemployment, so a little bit of a softening in the market there. On the Canadian side of the border, surprise move, huge number of new jobs added, and completely flat on jobless claims, like no movement at all.
Right.
So no softening at all.
Right. But there was there's some cracks in the data in the U.S. And, mm-hmm. and again, that I think that accounted for the early rally in U.S. equities, because although I think Powell has made it clear that the jobs data is not the primary driver of what interest rate policy is going to be, if we do start to see a softening of employment, we saw the unemployment numbers go higher. If layoffs start to increase, if the wage pressure comes out, that will be seen as positive. And so, Leanna, what I thought was interesting, when you look at the volatility, again, this is going to freak people out, but mm-hmm. we're getting closer to the end of the rate increases than we are at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the volatility is even increasing more based on the headlines, mm-hmm. right? So we're getting to this end, so it's getting nuanced about how far, how fast, what are we mm-hmm. pricing in, strategies. Mm-hmm. And so there tends to be a lot of trading action mm-hmm. around those key headlines.
Every headline is causing this moment-to-moment snap reaction right now.
Right.
Which I think is probably typical of that getting close to the end of trying to figure out exactly where the middle is. I don't know what you usually tell people who are in a situation where they're looking at their portfolios and it could be widely varied from mm-hmm. day to day.
Yeah.
What kinds of things would you actually say to somebody when they come to you and say, I don't know what to do?
What's going on?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So it's a good question. You can't, number one, I'll tell you what you can't do. You can't freeze, right? So you always have to go back, in my opinion, to what your economic thesis is, right? So you got to have an opinion as to how far rates are going to go, because you need something to judge. So, mm-hmm. you know, when you get a communication by the U.S. Fed or the Bank of Canada, okay, well, how does that compare to what we expected, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. you're positioning based on how you're expected in the future. Mm-hmm. So I think the message is don't freeze. Compare the headline relative to what your thesis says. Now, if it changes your thesis, then you might need to do some trading and change your portfolio. But if it doesn't change the thesis, then the daily volatility in the price action is just what it is, right? It doesn't necessarily change anything,
right?
Because we see, you know, you see a big drop on one day and then you see a massive rally the next day, right? You kind of just went to sleep and, you know, missed all of that stuff and everything was equal at the end of the day. That's kind of what you have to think about. So I caution people to get caught up too much in the day-to-day unless the data has changed, right? Based on whatever you think your thesis is. I would also, I think, argue a little bit about the role that recession is playing in this fear, right? So if we say that on the one hand, we're getting closer to the end of the interest rate hiking cycle, then that would imply that there's less concern about that and inflation than there is about the impact that these policy rate increases have had on the economy.
Right, and whether that economic slowdown is going to tip into recession or not.
Right, and so, you know, we had the Bank of Canada come out with their most recent forecast. Of course, they raised by 50 basis points, a little less than was expected last week. But the Bank of Canada's forecast for next year is growth, not recession, right? So they their forecast is for 0.9% growth. But they did say, our Bank of Canada governor did say, well, listen, it could just as easily be slightly negative versus slightly positive, right? Now, whether it's 0.9% growth or negative 0.9% growth, you know, those are going to feel pretty similar, right? It's going to be really slow. So this notion of a mild recession as a base case scenario is not unrealistic at this point, right? But that's not the Bank of Canada's forecast at this point, right? It's not recession. So somewhere in that band, I would say, seems to be what the Bank of Canada would be supportive of at this point, at this point, right? And we'll see, does the Fed, the US Fed, have to go further than what the Bank of Canada does? I would say the economists would argue yes to that, given that Canadians are more indebted than Americans generally. So we'll tend to, as a population, be a little bit more interest rate sensitive. Americans can lock in mortgages for 30 years. We've got 5 years, right? So there's a number of reasons why Canadians and the Canadian economy might be a little bit more sensitive to it, right? But you did see with a strong jobs report on Friday, a bit of a repricing of what that terminal rate, how far the Bank of Canada might have to go. And at least the initial trade on the Canadian dollar was crazy, right? It skyrocketed relative to the US dollar. So what can we take away from the sort of the day-to-day action in the markets?
I think the only thing we can take away from it is that it's volatile now.
Volatile.
That's the only thing we can say about it. It depends from moment to moment what the headline is of the minute. So it's going to be a bumpy ride for a little bit longer.
And truly the market on every one of those big headlines is trying to price, you know, it's testing the statement or the data against their thesis. And it's gonna bounce all over the place. Now, how long? You know, we could be in this, Leanna, for a while yet. We still need to see data. So each of the central banks, go with Bank of Canada and the Fed, has said they're gonna remain data dependent, right? And so that means they don't know, right? And here's the problem: market doesn't know. It's guessing 6 months into the future. Fed says they don't know they're gonna be data dependent. So we do have to keep our eyes on that data to see it and test it against, you know, what we're planning for in the future and make adjustments accordingly, right? You know, we always talk about the three Ds of tax planning: deduct, divide, and defer. And the disability tax credit is often one that people probably are unfamiliar with and may not be, you know, aware of how to take advantage of it, but it certainly falls within that. If there's a disability that you've got, you should be taking advantage of all of the different tax credits available to you. And so to try to remove some of the confusion, Leanna, around what it is and who should apply and how to apply, I think we've got a terrific guest to help us today. Dr. Wayne McLeod is a family physician, also the author of How to Successfully Apply for the Disability Tax Credit. Dr. McLeod, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, where do we start with this one, right?
I think the first question is, what is the disability tax credit and who's eligible for it?
So the disability tax credit is a federal tax credit. It's a federal grant, so a break on taxes owed for persons with a disability or for family members looking after a person with a disability. It originated in the days when Mr. O'Flaherty was our Minister of Finance, and it helps reflect the added costs that a person with either a physical or a mental disability incurs as a result of living with their illness. So it's a credit that covers both physical and mental disabilities. So people that are experiencing difficulties with their activities of daily living based on some either physical or psychological challenges. So the credit covers things like hearing loss, vision loss, illnesses or conditions that affect a person's ability to get dressed on their own or to walk on their own. As well, there are conditions covered where if a person has difficulties with feeding themselves or preparing meals or with their bowel and bladder functions. There's also an area in the credit that covers illnesses that require a time component to manage. So for instance, a person who has insulin-dependent diabetes, where there's a number of steps for managing their illness that take a number of hours in the run of the day. So these types of illnesses can be covered by this credit. It's an application that requires some assistance with a medical practitioner or someone familiar with the person with the disability to complete the credit. It needs to be filled out by a licensed practitioner, and then it's just sent to CRA for getting approval.
Dr. McLeod, I assume that there's some thresholds in these various areas that need to be met, and I suspect that's part of the reason why a family physician like yourself would need to be part of this process. But in your experience, how many people are not taking advantage of this that could be taking advantage of it?
The numbers vary. When you look at the number of persons who probably qualify, the credit is actually really underused. It's a terrific credit. I should mention, in addition to the tax break, there are also other benefits that come from being approved for this credit. So, for instance, if a child with a disability or a young person with a disability is able to open up a registered disability savings plan, and so which is another very, very good vehicle for a person to assist with the financial aspects of a disability. The current stats sort of suggest that one in four and one in five Canadians identify as living with a disability. But the number of persons that are accessing this credit is far below that. I guess almost 15-20% of eligible persons are applying for this. And I think that comes from a number of factors. I don't think the credit is very well known. It's not very well advertised. And because it does require the cooperation of a licensed practitioner to do the application, some folks who are aware of the credit wind up running into some barriers because practitioners may not be aware of what qualifies and what doesn't.
So I think you're right in that a lot of people are intimidated a little bit about the process of applying for this credit, even if they do know about it. So can you tell us a little bit about the steps that go into the application for this credit? What do you need to do? Who do you need to talk to? That kind of thing.
So the credit can be the application form can be completed by a licensed practitioner who has areas of expertise in the area of disability. So, for instance, for a visual impairment, an eye doctor or an ophthalmologist or a family doctor can fill out the requirements. For a hearing impairment, family doctor can do it, or an audiologist can do it. So you do need to liaise with a practitioner familiar with the type of deficit that's being described. The application form is the T2201. It's a simple form that you can download off of the Revenue Canada website. It's a 5 or 6 page form. The process for the applicant, once they've decided that they do qualify or that they want to do an application, is to just simply take the application to the person that they're going to have fill it out. And those criteria are there in the application form. So for instance, for the visual impairment, there's a certain level of visual acuity that the person should meet. Now the person's eye doctor or their family doctor should be familiar with that and able to sort of certify that information. The only really real intimidating part in my view or in my experience is getting cooperation sometimes, because unfortunately none of us family doctors like to do paperwork anyway, and to get a application done, sometimes practitioners are kind of pigeonholed into what qualifies and what doesn't, and unfortunately I think a lot of people are missing out on that basis, and that's sort of why I wrote that little ebook, to just to sort of broaden the horizons of people who might be thinking about doing an application.
And I go back to my question about thresholds, Dr. McLeod. So when you fill this out, are there certain standard thresholds for visual acuity or a mental illness of some sort that are CRA approved, or is it a bit of a moving target?
Well, that's a great question. The physical impairments tend to be a whole lot more cut and dried, so we speak. So a person is defined as having an impairment in one of these areas if they're unable to do that particular thing themselves, or if it takes them three times longer than a person who is not impaired. So for instance, in every area of qualification, so let's say the walking impairment, if a person is wheelchair confined, that's pretty black and white. If a person is unable to walk without assistance, definitely qualify. The moving target aspect kind of comes into play when you also qualify if it takes you three times as long as someone who's unimpaired to walk a given distance. So that sometimes leaves open to interpretation. But in my view, it's usually pretty obvious. If a person is coming to see their doctor and they're limping quite badly, or they're using crutches or using a walker, those types of things, you can make a case for those things by elaborating on the type of impairment. So the type of impairment has to be such that it causes the person three times as long to perform an activity compared to someone who is not impaired, and it has to have a sufficient sort of duration. So it's not for temporary impairments, it's for impairments that have lasted for a year or longer, or expected to last a year or longer. The mental functions are a little bit less cut and dry, because again, there's a certain amount of interpretation over what constitutes severe depression or severe anxiety. But they have gone through some iterations of the application to make these things a little bit more clear.
Dr. McLeod, if somebody is hoping to apply for the disability tax credit and want to get a hold of your ebook, how do they do that?
So it's on Amazon, and it's called How to Successfully Apply for the Disability Tax Credit. It's there. When I did this, this was kind of a weekend project where I really didn't know what I was getting into at the time. So unfortunately, there is a little charge for it, because I didn't know that you were allowed to put things on there for free until after the fact. I'm also available by email if a person wants to just consult with me and ask questions. I'm very happy to go over a case with a person. Love to meet or connect with people, particularly financial planners who are doing this kind of work for their clients. And my email address is widely available.
Well, that's great. Listen, we've quickly run out of time here on a topic that can be both frightening and difficult to navigate. And I want to thank you very much for taking some time with us, and I think shedding some light on what it is and who can apply and how to apply for that. So, Dr. McLeod, thanks for taking some time with us today.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been joined by Dr. Wayne McLeod, who's a family physician, but he's also the author of How to Successfully Apply for the Disability Tax Credit. We have four buckets, Leanna, and I'm sure people are tired of hearing about our four buckets. But the four buckets are really important because it generally addresses sort of the four really key areas in families' lives, in general terms, right? Income, growth, health, and legacy. And I have to say, my experience with the legacy bucket is often the most rewarding work that we do with client families, because it's really about, it's about your gift to family, kids, charities, whatever the case may be, right? So it's for families that are simply, they've got more wealth than they need to support their retirement lifestyle. They pass, and now they want to pass along this gift. However, it's interesting. It's an interesting experience in dealing with people at this, because there's a reluctance sometimes to talk about the true family dynamics, right? At least initially.
Well, and I'm not sure it's just the family dynamics that people are reluctant to talk about. It's everything to do with wills and estate planning that tends to be a bit of a hurdle for people.
Fair.
It's whether it's not wanting to talk about the fact that you might pass away at some point, whether you don't necessarily want to acknowledge, or you don't want to tell other people about issues in your family or things you might be experiencing. I think one of the things that people forget is that everybody has these issues.
Right. And so we were talking to somebody just this week, and their comment was, thank you for having the conversation, because it normalizes it, right? We shine that a light in that dark corner. And then when you realize this, and we're fortunate because we get to have lots of these conversations, so we understand that dynamics in every family is normal. But for those people that are listening that think, I've got some terrible situation I'm dealing with, not to minimize the situation, it might be a difficult situation, but everybody's got difficult situations, which is why it becomes important to do these things, right? Because you don't want that to tear a family apart.
That's exactly right. And if you are one of those people who are thinking about avoiding doing some sort of estate planning because you're worried about having to deal with all of these issues, or you're worried about creating more complication in your family, my suggestion would be, or I would argue, that it's actually more complicated if you don't do that plan.
Right.
The worst thing you can possibly do is not plan at all.
Yeah. And so you're uniquely positioned in this business as well because of your background, your educational background is around law. And so you understand this, I think, better than most. And then it's interesting for you to be able to bring sort of this wealth advisory perspective, the big umbrella, mm-hmm. to it. And there's some things that people generally need to know about this. Tell me a little bit about the differences in the type of people in your life, because some have certain rights that others don't. Okay?
Right.
Talk to me about that.
So I would generally categorize the groups of people that a court or the legal system would look at as your children, mm-hmm. which sometimes doesn't coincide with who might be your dependents or people who rely on you for financial support, your spouse,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of everybody else,
yep.
becomes the last category. And among those three different groups, people have different rights, and it's different depending on what province you're in.
Yeah.
So that's a major consideration that needs to be taken into account when you're talking with your lawyer in order to set up an estate plan. But generally speaking, and again, this is depending on what province you're in, your children very often have rights, mm-hmm. that others in your family don't.
Right.
Now, if you want to treat those children all the same, you may not have an issue, but if you want to treat them differently or distribute your assets differently because of, I don't know, whether you've done something for them during their lifetimes that you're taking into account in your estate plan or something else,
yeah.
then it becomes a little bit dicey, because some of the courts in some of the provinces may force you to have a more equal distribution than you might have planned for.
Right, right. And a spouse carries, again, a privileged position in most provinces and in most cases. And think about the complexity that gets added if that spouse is, say, a second marriage, mm-hmm. Versus a first marriage, mm-hmm. that adds a level of complexity. We've done some shows in the past on that. But it's this, I think this idea of normalization, I really thought a lot about that when that question came up, because generationally, we see differences too, right? And so we deal with typically a crowd that is either transitioning to or living in retirement. And if people are deep in retirement, a little older, I would say, generally speaking, that generation has been a little bit more tight-lipped in terms of their financial situation and whatnot. And that leads to some challenges.
Right. So if you've never talked about your assets with your family, or you don't really want to share what your plans are for your estate wishes because you're worried about, you either just don't talk about it as a family and it's not normal for you,
yeah,
or you are worried about how they're going to react to it,
yeah,
that could create some issues of its own.
Yeah.
Because if the first time that somebody is finding out about your estate wishes is when you've passed on and they open up the will, all they have to go on is what's written in that legal document. There's nothing typically in that document about why you've chosen to do things right this way, or what your rationale was for, you know, maybe perhaps adding something to one child that the other child didn't get, or treating them equally, or if they don't believe that it should be fair and equal. I've seen cases like that, right, where, you know, it's a farming family and one of the children stays behind and works on the farm and the other two move off, and the one that's working on the farm expects some sort of compensation in that arrangement, but then the division is equal.
Right.
So depending on your particular family situation, and this is, it's very situation dependent.
100%.
But if you've never talked about it, then you're going, then you may be opening up the door for issues,
right,
amongst your children when you've passed on. And you're not there for them to ask you.
Right.
And that's the hardest part.
We often say, we've never sat down with anybody who said, my goal is to tear my family apart.
Exactly.
That's my estate goal. I want to make sure that there's a big legal, ugly legal battle and it rips my family apart.
Mm-hmm.
But it can often be the smallest things, right, that do that. So the way one person reads and interprets that equal distribution could be very different than somebody else. And the conclusions they draw without the context of having the conversation, to your point, can often lead down very different paths.
Well, everybody's idea of fair,
right,
is different.
Right.
And so if you have two or three kids that disagree on what fair looks like,
yeah,
the court battles are long and ugly, and very often families don't recover from something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think our advice, we can say generally speaking, is take the time, obviously, to prepare the proper legal documents. But beyond that, we see it every day. Those families that have the conversations about intent and context and so on and so forth tend to have fewer problems than those that don't. And the thing is also that things change. So whatever, mm-hmm, you know, every 3 to 5 years, you should probably be reviewing things and having conversations, mm-hmm, because things change in kids' lives and so on and so forth as well. So it's like everything else in retirement. It's not a set and forget kind, no, of a strategy, is it?
No. And I mean, I've spoken to people this week who have said, oh, I haven't actually looked at my will since 2000.
Right.
Okay, well, you've added 3 or 4 grandkids since then, and perhaps, you know, want to provide something for them and their education, and
yeah,
that's not included anywhere. And so your wishes will change.
Right.
And your family will change. And as those things happen, all of these documents need to be updated. Unfortunately, it is a bit of a process to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something that you kind of add to your regular schedule of updating, particularly with us, when you update your financial plan and you update the goals you have, you just incorporate those wishes for your family for the future into that sort of update process.
Yeah.
To make sure that it's always fitting with your wishes.
Yeah, that's right. Whatever's, yeah, current at that particular time. Okay, we got to wrap this show up and bring it home strong. One of the, you know, when you and I were talking before the show, we were talking a little bit about sort of the common themes of what we're talking to people about. And it didn't take very long before we kind of concluded that the conversations today at this point in the cycle are, you know, are really about, can I retire?
Mm-hmm.
Markets are down, inflation is high. Should that stop me from retiring this year? Or I'm in retirement and should I stop living my retirement life, the one that I've envisioned, because markets are down or inflation's high and so on and so forth? And the common denominator of this is the impact, right, that those elements that I've just talked about, markets being down, mm-hmm. have on the long term. So we've got the short term emotional experience. People are exhausted right mm-hmm. now. I get it. Mm-hmm. But should that, Leanna, change a person's 30-year decision about going into retirement or living their life in retirement? Your thoughts?
I mean, the short answer that we would tell people is no, right? It's difficult to make a decision about the next 30 years of your life, or even the next 2 years of your life. Should I work two more years because inflation is high right now, was right. a question that I got this week. The short answer is no.
Right.
But it has to make sense for when you retire.
Right.
But what I would suggest that people think about when they look at something like this is what's really driving, like, what is the actual number that you need? Do you have data that backs up that question in your mind where you're saying, I need a certain amount, inflation is impacting me enough that it is impacting that number? Or is this a gut feeling because you're seeing a headline and the headline is scary? So the first question that we start with is, are those things that are happening in the headlines impacting you?
Right.
And how are they impacting you?
Right. And even if there is an impact, markets are down, your portfolio's down a little bit, you know, the question is, should that short-term issue change the long-term? And I'm going to throw this at you. We always talk about structure and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to minimize the impact that a down market can have, because mm-hmm. it can affect things, and it can affect things negatively. There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
The question really we should be asking ourselves is, can you properly structure yourself in a way to protect against it? Because let's face it, this isn't going to be the last problem we have, right? You just have to go back to 2020 right. for the most recent one.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to 2018, mm-hmm. you know. Creep back to 2015, we had a problem.
Yep.
2008-09, we had a problem. Mm-hmm. And there'll be problems in the future. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we know with certainty is that there's going to be problems, and there's mm-hmm. always things to worry about. But talk to me about what your thoughts are and the conversations you've had with respect to this notion of structure and discipline of how you organize yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. There's always going to be an issue. You're yep. going to have some issue that you're encountering. The question is, how are you positioned to either avoid, mitigate the risk, you know, avoid damage in while those issues are going on. And that's where you say the structure comes into play. Part of that is looking at the range of different possibilities that might happen over the next, you know, 1, 3, 5 years.
Yep.
Part of that is the structure of not planning for just that 1 year time horizon where it's just this month or this year or the next 18 months of inflation that I'm worried about and nothing else beyond that matters. This, if you're in retirement specifically, which is who we deal with, if you're looking at that time horizon and you're retiring today, that could be 30 years long.
That's right.
So if you're just planning for the next 18 months, you're going to get this sense that you're never fully comfortable about your future.
Right.
Because you're never looking far enough ahead. That being said, 30 years ahead is not the only place that you have to look. There has to be a structure in place for what is going to happen in the next 6 months and what's going to happen in the next year.
Yeah.
That's why you and Faisal have always championed the notion of these four buckets.
Yeah.
The income and growth bucket are split up specifically for that reason, so yeah. that your today money is protected,
right.
but your future money can grow.
Right.
And your future money also can mitigate the risks of any of these issues occurring, because they will happen.
Yeah, and it's an average over time too, mm-hmm. right? So even in a market, in a fixed income market that was, you know, wild this year relative to what we've seen for decades, you exit this position with yields much higher, which is terrific for savers.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of structure and discipline, that inside that notion of discipline is the idea of stay, like, keep moving, right? You can't mm-hmm. freeze.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look where the opportunities are and take advantage of those opportunities. And if whether it's in the bond market, fixed income market, or the stock market or the alternatives market, or even in tax, right? Mm-hmm. How to take advantage of tax as part of the wealth strategy. And if you've got, we get to the end of the year, tax loss selling opportunities to go and recover mm-hmm. taxable income that you can then put back into the market mm-hmm. at higher yields or lower prices and lower valuations on mm-hmm. stocks. There's so many things that can be done. I think people have to, you have to start with the structure, the discipline, have a strategy. But within that strategy, remember, it's not set and forget. Mm-hmm. There's lots of stuff to do. And mm-hmm. you should be taking advantage of those opportunities all the time, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so here's I'm going to throw some stats at you. It's a good news, bad news story. Mm-hmm. So if you were frozen, if you're the kind of person that emotionally, you know, you've shut your life down or you're going to work longer because markets are down or inflation is high. Let's just go with markets are down. Here's historically the stats. 22% of the time, markets are down. Mm-hmm. 78% of the time, markets are higher. Now, I wonder how people just heard that. Did they hear, oh my goodness, I got to put my life on hold?
1/4 of the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or did they hear, most of the time markets are higher. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the down years, okay, the average over time, gets mm-hmm. more than made up for in the up years. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a bit of a glass half full, glass mm-hmm. half right. empty kind of right. fun sort of mental yep. exercise to do. But those statistics are accurate. Mm-hmm. Right. So although we tend to emotionally feel down markets, if you're a behavioral finance person, mm-hmm. They would tell you 10 times as strongly as mm-hmm. we enjoy the up markets. Right. Mm-hmm. The down is 10 times more powerful on an emotional reaction basis.
That's called negativity bias. And right. That's why every time you look at your portfolio and it's off a little bit from where you were, it feels way worse than making 20%, you know, it's scary to do that. Now, I want to ask you this question. When you say freeze, it's not just delaying retirement, is it?
When I say free?
Freeze.
Oh, freeze,
when people are freezing and, you know, saying, I don't want to retire this year because of inflation or markets or whatever. It's not just delaying retirement or delaying doing some of those things. Freezing can also count as going to cash.
Ah, yeah, that's an excellent point, actually. Sure. And we're going to pick on cash, but it's not just cash. That's a reaction by people to try to stop the pain, mm-hmm. right? Stop the down. What's interesting about the cash call is it tends to be a 100% mm-hmm. call, right? Mm-hmm. This is where I have an issue. I don't have an issue with holding cash in a portfolio or whatever. Mm-hmm. That could be part of the strategy. But when somebody goes 100% any asset class, mm-hmm. what their thesis is, right? They have a 100% probability that whatever they're worried about is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I both know we live in a world of approximately right, hopefully most of the time, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Success in our business is approximately right most of the time. Mm-hmm. So the reason I say that is because you have to humbly ask yourself, what if you're wrong, right? And we talk about you can be wrong two ways. It can mm-hmm. be better than you expect or worse than you expect. But certainly what it challenges is this notion that I know exactly what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that earlier in the show, right? Mm-hmm. The Fed doesn't know what they're going to do because it's data dependent. They don't mm-hmm. know what the data is going to show. Mm-hmm. So any call, cash, going to cash, whatever it might be, 100%, mm-hmm. I want people to think about it in that context, mm-hmm. right? That you are saying you are 100% probability of this outcome.
Mm-hmm. And you're making an all-in bet that you are going to get out of the market at the right time and get back into the market at exactly the right time.
Right. Yeah, there's two very, very difficult timing decisions to mm-hmm. make when you make all-in bets on anything, cash, stocks, bonds, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. Anyways, I think that's an interesting conversation to have. There's a couple of thought experiments in this segment that I mm-hmm. think we can leave people with and have a glass of wine and sort of think over those things. And mm-hmm. And if you have any questions, obviously you can reach out to us. But we will host our next upcoming seminar mm-hmm. in which, guaranteed, we're talking about these topics, right? And how to properly structure and the discipline mm-hmm. you need to bulletproof your retirement. Why don't we remind everybody when that's happening?
Mm-hmm. So our next seminar is Tuesday, November 15th at 7 p.m. We're hosting it both live here in Calgary at the Silver Springs Golf and Country Club, but you can also attend online. You do have to register, so go to morethanmoneyradio.com, fill in your information, and we'll hopefully see you there.
Well, on behalf of Leanna and myself, Dave, I want to thank you for tuning in to another edition of More Than Money on 770 CHQR, and we look forward to chatting with you next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Karmeli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Karmeli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets, Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets, Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.